Eso sí me encanta. I see Stan, Todd, and Hart. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yep.
Sweet. Okay. I'm going to check with Tracy as to what's actually happening with these, as to why this seems to be a recurring issue with us being unable to start.
They have a capacity of essentially one conference per Zoom account. And so somebody else is just like leaving the old meeting open.
Well, the worst part is that somebody dialed into a meeting that didn't even occur today. So they dialed in and left themselves dialed in.
Okay.
Yeah, and I don't know how to stop that. I mean, that's in order to run these meetings at times when I'm not around, I set them up so that they start before the host. And so there's, unless I change it to not start before the host, but unfortunately the only host can be people at the Linux Foundation.
Yeah. Can these be auto shut down though? I mean, I think that's the big thing.
Yeah, I checked the other day after this had happened a few times, and the, you know, you can schedule them for certain times, but people can basically start them at any time, regardless of the fact that you've said it only starts like at 8 and runs to 9 or something like that, right? So it's obviously something that Zoom is going to have to fix, because, you know, this is a recurring theme.
Yeah. So it basically means if you're not at a meeting, or someone from the Linux Foundation is not at a meeting, we're kind of all held hostage.
Yeah. By somebody in the community who's decided to dial into a meeting that's not even happening.
Right.
Yeah. Wonderful. Well, if we ever need to miss meetings, you know, we know how to deny our service. You know,
Be careful what you ask for.
Next time I want to sleep in, you know, I'll have that script dial in to.
I love it. Morning, Vipin.
Good morning.
I'm going to put you on the spot today, because you're going to have to help us get out of this conundrum we've gotten ourselves into with the ideal system. Actually, it's you and Todd, at least, are the ones that are going to have to sort of lead us to the promised land on this. So just to sort of go back and recap where we're at. So we've been having this discussion about the ideal system. The idea behind the ideal system is that it captures the way we think the system should ideally operate. In a perfect world where we can invent notions of trusted third parties and expect them to behave the way we want them to, we need to sort of articulate what those parties are and describe what the characteristics are, and then we can go back and map those into to the existing systems, or compare existing systems against the ideal system for it. We have sort of two models of approach that we've been kind of going back and forth between. One model was what we started with, and what we, you know, probably have most thoroughly documented is essentially it's the bulletin board model. It's the model of sort of a traditional distributed ledger, where the trusted third party, where parties send a message to the trusted third party, the trusted third party broadcasts those messages out to all participants. By using particular encoding of the messages, we can make sure that only selected participants are able to see it. But by doing the broadcast, then it's difficult to correlate who's actually receiving those messages. And so we can hide the kind of details of what the communication is with a trusted third party. One of the weaknesses we ended up with on that one, there were two, but one was that the identity of the originator of the original messages being sent to the trusted third party potentially exposes some information. So in our usage, the seller initiates the auction by sending a message to the trusted third party, who broadcasts that out to the potential factors. So the message to the factors is hidden, but the message from the seller is not. Responses from the factors then, likewise, are not hidden. They're visible because they're going across a public network for the communication pieces of it. And so while they can't immediately be decoded, there's a potential correlation between the supplier sending a message out and the factors responding to it. So for example, you could imagine in an idle system, the supplier sends something out, the factors receive the broadcast message, three factors to whom it was targeted respond, and now we kind of have an ability to correlate who's responsible for the selling and who the factors are that are responding to it. So we got to that point and we kind of stopped. So this was where we ended up with the discussion about identities and a bunch of other things with that. And then we started going to the other direction, which was more of the second ideal model was trying to come up with a way of describing something that's closer to what Corda does, where you have pairwise channels, or sort of as an in-between step, the Fabric's notion of channels.
Hold on a second. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, if you're discussing the ideal system, why confuse it with the real world? Why not say that there is a private channel between the supplier and the central trusted third party? Then the other end is between the factors and the trusted third party, so that nobody can see anything other than the trusted third party. You're constructing this ideal abstract model, and then you're injecting the real world into it, as if there seems to be a confusion in the level of abstraction. So either you go for the trusted third party model and not bother about how it's done, or you make a model that exists in the real world with things like Corda, Hyperledger, Fabric, Sawtooth, and so on and so forth. You can't have a mixture of both. You either sit in one corner or the other.
No, Vipit.
I think part of what we were doing with the... go ahead, Hart.
The point is that you show the two worlds are kind of equivalent, so that any attack that works on the real model also works on the ideal model, essentially. So you showed that the whole point of this is to show that an adversary learns... an adversary in the real world learns the same things an adversary in the ideal world would learn, right? So, I mean, I don't, the separate corner thing isn't exactly what we're shooting for. What we want is a real world and an ideal world we can relate. And this is because the ideal world is much simpler and will let us rigorously analyze kind of what is leaked or what an adversary sees, you know, what privacy properties we get, all of these good things. Does that make sense, Vivin?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't make sense to me, because if you're constructing an ideal world, you construct that ideal world. Then you attack it. Okay, you can attack it with various ways, and then you start constraining that ideal world further. Now you say, okay, how can I reconstruct this ideal world in the real world?
We're not...
either direct constructs or with, adding layers like ZK or whatever you want. You can add a signal protocol with noise. You can add this, you can add that in order to prevent leakage. I don't see how, you construct this abstraction and then you say, oh, The ideal abstraction wouldn't leak, right? I mean, wouldn't say, I wouldn't be able to see what you're sending, which supplier is sending the demand. Otherwise, why have this trusted third party? I mean,
Vipin, the point is that some of these ideal worlds we can't reach, right? We want to get an ideal world that we can actually reach in practice,
right?
We can reach this ideal world. I can tell you that we can reach this ideal world, and people have constructed this
with private channels.
You have to have very strong primitives to reach this.
You have to have very strong primitives, but they can be layered on top of either Fabric or on top of any
Not without
losing efficiencies. Hang on a second.
So let's talk about that for just a second. So and this goes back specifically to the channels issue, right? Which is communication is one of those things that we can protect the contents of the messages well, but we can't protect from observation well. So even in the case, channels give us privacy and secure communication. Not really, because the messages are going across the internet. Right? So unless we implement it with a private pairwise fiber connections, it's very difficult to do that. So I think, what we're trying to do is this balancing act right now. And Hart, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is my understanding. We're trying to build an ideal system which we could envision how we could build the real system that parallels it. So that ideal system has to, in some sense, be a simplification of the assumptions.
Not ideal.
It's not utopian. Let me say it's not utopian, right?
This is where I have a difficulty. If you guys think that you're proceeding the right way, go ahead. I mean, I don't have a problem with that, but I am just not convinced. Okay, no matter how much you somersault around this.
What are you not convinced of, Vipin?
I'm not convinced that you are modeling an ideal system. You're modeling some system that exists in your mind as with real world limitations.
Yeah, yeah. Don't get hung up on the term ideal. That's just a technical term.
No, I'm not hung up on the term ideal. The problem with this approach that you are proposing is that you are cutting off solutions. You don't know the solution does not mean that solution does not exist. Okay, you don't know the way in which this particular thing can be done does not mean that particular thing cannot be done. If people listen to other people telling them it cannot be done, nothing would get done in this world, right? I mean, there are always skeptic guys who come and say, no, it cannot be done. So what I'm proposing is go for the ideal system. Then you say, okay, let's inject reality into it. How does it change each of these interactions? That's what I'm proposing. Not, I'm not saying that, I want to construct this system in, on Uranus or whatever, whichever planet you choose. But, I'm talking about, going for the ultimate and then saying, can this ultimate be reached? If not, why? And where do we have problems?
Hey guys, Ram here. Well, sorry, I joined late, but catching up on how we ended up in planet Uranus. What is the contention here?
So we're trying to come up. So the activity we've been doing for the last couple of weeks has been trying to come up with a description of a model that allows us to do an analysis. The term that's used is ideal system model, right? And so I think the challenge here is, Vipin's observation is that, well, if we're going ideal, why not just really go ideal? We could do things like declare that they're private, unobservable channels between participants. And I think there's this balancing act where we're trying to get enough, I don't know if reality is the right word. It's this interesting sort of abuse of terms in some sense. But a simplified model might be better than ideal model, but that conflict is between how far do we go towards ideal versus mm-hmm. how much reality do we inject into the model. So for example, private unobservable channels is something that's been postulated for the last 50 years, but the only implementation of private unobservable channels that I'm aware of involves physically deploying hardware. So I had no problem starting with the assumption that we could, we would just start the model with, we could create private messages, but we can't create private channels. And I think Vipin's bringing up a very good point, which is, you know, should we be throwing stuff out too soon?
Got it.
So Art, did I capture that?
Pretty much, but like, for example, you took out a straw man and demolished it right there by saying the private unobservable channels are what we are talking about. I mean, you know, that is not what I was talking about. You know, the point is, can the suppliers, you know, name or whatever it is, be observed by a man in the middle attack? I mean, you know, that who has complete control over the communication channel, right? I mean, isn't that what you're saying?
But does that,
But
unless you can remove all routers in between, then you can't guarantee primitive of unobservability. Right. And so
where the person who's attacking has complete control over the communication channel.
So maybe you know, instead of calling it just a terminology issue, right? Instead of calling it the ideal model, maybe we should call it the reference model. And then we can have different versions of the reference model. Okay. And I guess
this is my objection to all of this is the fact that by constraining it, we are constraining it with, you know, what we know of the systems, rather than what is possible, because
So let's. So from an
आपकी call hold पर है. क्या है 5 6 7 8 9? अभी मुफ्त call करें और जाने क्या है 5 6 7 8 9.
That must be Amit. Whoever it is. Anyway.
Oh, wow.
That was an interesting interception.
From a practical point of view, maybe we should. Sorry, Vipin, can I?
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I hear what you're saying, which is, you know, let's not do the ideal thing. Let's do something that we think is possible.
Guys, this is just a proof method. This isn't like, you know, it's not, we're constraining this, you know, this is just a way to argue about security of blockchains. I don't see why you're like, if the terminology isn't the greatest, but like the ideal model is a technical crypto term. It's what like some very famous people in the like, you know, early 2000s called it when they developed this kind of universal composability, which is also.
So Hart, I think, let's address it step by step, right? So the first one is just terminology. Maybe you can just call it the reference model or something. But I think the second underlying problem that Vipin is bringing up is that maybe the assumptions that we are making are a little too strict, in the sense that in a practical system, there might be communications methods that are practical and provide, you know, even if it's not completely provable, that they are fairly isolated, right?
Yeah, so two things here about those comments. The terminology is not really up for debate. If we try to use something that exists and rename it, we're going to look like idiots. To your second point, yes, you're exactly right, that if we want to make different assumptions about the model we're working in and you know, kind of about the environment, that's totally acceptable.
Like, I didn't say change the name. I didn't say change the name. I never said that. I said
I'm just saying. But you are right.
That's a wrong suggestion.
I know. I know.
The reference model. So
you're right, Vipin, that if you want to, you can create kind of all different worlds that you want, right? You know, if you want to assume, you know, stronger things, like you do have private channels or you know, other things like that, you can totally do that. You know, there's no stopping you. So again, you can create kind of whatever assumptions you want. That's the joy of this whole paradigm, is that if you, you know, we, and this is what kind of we were going to put on you today, is to come up with a set of constraints
exactly
that were going to be acceptable. So this was going to be your job at the meeting today, is you were going to lay out and say, this is what banks are willing to assume about, you know, communication or models or other things like that, right? So,
yes.
So, but yes, you can kind of, you know, okay,
I can only talk about what they currently accept, right?
Yeah,
that's exactly what we're looking for.
That's what we want to know.
And by the way, Todd, I'm putting you on the hook as well for this. So this is what we'd like to hear. Stan?
Stan would probably be able to say much better than I what they accept currently, because he's involved in a direct project with, you know, CME. And, you know, in fact, they communicate with so many people. I mean, it's not just point-to-point kind of thing. So he should be able to say that as well. But currently, they do accept the fact of using the internet as a communication medium, right? So obviously, any one of those things that you just said before, which is observable, you know, if anybody can observe that traffic, you know, they can. I mean, if they can. You know, so the only protection you have is some kind of, you know, to obscure the data, nothing else, or using some, you know, third, some other means of communication, which is going to, you know, like what Tor or something does, you know, going to some like third party thing.
Actually, I want to say that we actually only truly trust something if it's physically originated within our networks. We have collocation and VPN, but even VPN is kind of subject to suspicion because we don't know the security on the other end.
So, yeah, but when you do transact with other companies, you accept a certain medium of communication, right? I mean, it's... like and, the internet right. can and, be used.
Of course, and we actually attach to each medium, we attach its own kind of a threat level.
Yes, certainly.
So are we going here for the lowest, most practical, most popular model and then assess its...
So would it be appropriate then when we talk about the channels that, and by the way, I don't mean channels in the fabric sense, I mean communication channels, you know, where we put packets. Would it be appropriate for us in the model to capture this notion of different kinds of channels and the communication that's allowed on those different channels being reflective of a policy that's associated with them? That is, for example, a physical connection could exist between two parties in a single network, and that has certain communication is allowed to go over that, but a channel across the internet, even though it's VPN, may have certain observability characteristics, and the communication that's allowed to go over that is different. Would that be reflective of the policies that you're using?
Well, usually, like Stan said, you know, you have, let's talk about very simple case. You know, you have a labeling on documents, okay? You say confidential, then you say private, and then you say public. I mean, public, of course, is available to everybody. A private can go over certain channels, let's say using HTTPS or something. If it is confidential, then like Stan says, you know, if it is originating within your own network, like you can email it to your colleague who's on the same network, but not email it outside the firm. You know, even if or email, forget email. You can use some kind of protection mechanism and send it, let's say SFTP or some other mechanism to send it outside. It will be prevent, you know, that will be prevented if it's a, so there are, you know, indeed levels of, in this case, let's say privacy, attached to every piece of information.
Okay, and just to be clear, there are cost models associated with each of those as well, presumably. A physical connection is expensive, and a long-haul physical connection is extremely expensive. A VPN is a lot less expensive, but still has some performance implications, and public networks, where we're simply encrypting the messages over a public channel, is less normally expensive.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right, but I don't think the cost consideration comes into the picture, but we're not talking about, you know, lots and lots of communications, lot of data passing back and forth and so on. So those costs hardly ever come into the picture because we're not talking about huge numbers or frequency of data transmissions, even in the system that we are talking about, like the supply chain finance. I mean, you know, if you model the amount of data that passes through, the cost considerations would be the least, least problematic. I mean, you're right that if you were to use or to even string a private line, then that would, you know, there would be a fixed cost associated with that, and that you would do that only if, you know, you have huge amounts of data passing back and forth, or there is some competitive advantage to having that, like having a line into the exchange so that you can programmatically trade or whatever the implications are. But that, you know, let's say that, you know, like Stan says, that there is a value attached to the privacy of the communication, and that controls what channels are allowed to be used. But in the case of a supply chain financing, you are necessarily going to interact with those people, like the suppliers. You know, the network of the supply chain finance will necessarily, use the open internet, but of course with protections in order to communicate between the parties, because there won't be private wires strung.
Okay, so then sort of coming back to our, and I'm going to use the term reference model, even though I know, Hart, that if we write this up, it has to be different than that, okay? Just to avoid that particular conflict. In our reference model, how should we describe the characteristics of the communication channels between the participants? What is an appropriate description of those channels?
Meaning,
as far as the characteristics of the channel, right? Are they observable? Are they, we have to be able to move bits from participants. What assumptions should we make about the bits that are moving that are representative of the situation?
You make is that you use whatever technology is at your disposal to do encryption or other methods, like injecting noise, whatever the additional things are to obfuscate the sender and the receiver. I mean, you don't anticipate somebody anticipate somebody attaching sniffers, but they can't learn anything more than there is traffic.
The issue, yeah, right, is they can learn traffic, and maybe, you know, maybe traffic reveals something, right?
Sure.
So the whole goal of this exercise, Vipin, is to allow for an easy way for someone to see in a real instance what this sort of traffic leaks or what these communication patterns leak. That's the goal, right? Because in many applications, it's unacceptable for this to be leaked, right? So the whole goal, I'm sorry if this has been confusing, but the whole goal of this
No, it's not a confusing at all. The point is you're coming at all this stuff from the extreme end. So I suggested taking it to the absolute extreme. The other point, you know, because people do communicate over the internet today, right? I mean, they do conduct trillions of dollars of business on it. And I'm sure if somebody wanted to observe the traffic, they can do so. You know, if they are powerful enough state actors or whatever, you know, if they hack into the, if it's NSA or if it's somebody else who can hack into the routers and the and the other backbones of the internet. But I don't know whether, you know, it prevents people from actually doing business.
Well, whoever, I mean, it doesn't even have to be hacking at that level. It can be whoever's running your validator network, for example, can see the source of all the communication. So.
Validator network. Okay, so now we're coming to blockchains. Okay, fine.
I mean, that there's a point at which these have to come back to what the problem is that we're trying to solve, right?
Okay.
So we have some notion of an architecture for committing transactions, right? What are the characteristics of that architecture? Well, at some point, everyone who's participating in a communication has to come to agreement about the state of the communication, right? And we've got some trusted third party. And I think where we've been sort of questioning on the model construction is there a trusted third party for each group of interacting participants? So for example, can you imagine the creation of a specific trusted third party for the participants, for the supplier, the buyer, and the factors. And that comes, that's a transient kind of thing, and it comes into existence to manage the connections there. Well, that's great, except for the fact that the information that comes out of that interaction about who has ownership of it has to feed into other things. And so now we have to have a channel between that trusted third party and some next consumer of the information that comes out of it. So, I mean, we can go that direction, or we can go the other direction, which is, you know, let's look at this more like what we have with a ledger. If we're trying to solve this, then there's a sort of global authority that we're representing as our trusted third party, and that global authority maintains all of the state. So I think both of those are techniques that could be used to address, to create representations for different kinds of solution spaces that would allow us to do different kinds of analysis on it. I think where I thought we were was trying to figure out which of those is most representative and most appropriate for the kind of problems and expectations and requirements and constraints that are realistic for the banks and the financial institutions today. That is for this particular usage. So, is it realistic to imagine that a group of participants is able to construct some infrastructure that has certain characteristics on a one-off kind of basis? Or is there something in the middle that we're missing?
I don't know. That was a whole bunch of words. the thing that I'm struggling with is one angle is we're taking a business use case, right? And we are describing it somehow. We are saying, okay, the supplier sends out the, you know, requests to finance the invoices. So who all are privileged to see it? Only the guys who's the target of those requests. the second case is the targets now are bidding on this. And obviously, I think even the targets do not see each other's request from the same supplier. You know, you're basically saying, the supplier asked me, but I don't see that supplier also asked XYZ. But I can imagine that that happens because, you know, that's how the business works. I don't know the details of that particular request. The other one is where I'm bidding. My bid goes into, you know, it's like a sealed bid, almost like a sealed bid auction, right? I mean, nobody knows except the person who decides which bid to take. And that those are the business constraints. I mean, if you say, oh, you know, by breaking into the internet, I can observe, you know, the supplier sending stuff to others, you know, that, okay, that's neither here nor there. You know, we're going to the traffic analysis part now. I mean, we're talking about the basic use case. Can this be supported without, you know, that's the first thing. Second thing we'll say is, okay, then what else can be known if we break into this, into the channels, you know? I'm all for concrete things, not, you know, like, okay, there exist validator nodes or central authorities who will look at everything, you know. If you construct a central authority, you obviously imply that that central authority is in some way or form inviolable, right? I mean, you can't just
subvert. That's not the point. The point of coming up with a trusted third party is to describe what the characteristics are of that
Forget
the so that we can actually do the analysis. So, and hang on. Hold it, okay?
Yeah.
So, notions of validators and other things is my way of trying to make it as concrete as possible, right? So when you're doing your channel in Fabric, you are sending your transactions to some set of servers that are doing the computation. Do you trust those servers? And if you do, why? Once those servers have done the computation, you've collected all the results and you need to submit something to the ordering service. You're now submitting information that exposes some of the details of your interaction to the ordering service. Do you trust the ordering service? And why? And how do we capture those trust relationships that you have that are institutional as requirements for the model so that we can do a formal analysis to see whether or not Fabric or Sawtooth or Aroha or these others are able and to meet the requirements? And then at the end, can we go back and modify them, suggest modifications to them that will address the privacy concerns? That's what we're trying to accomplish. Right.
Sure.
So let's be real specific. So do you as a bank trust the collection of servers that you are communicating your transaction with as endorsers for your transaction in a particular channel? And why? What are the characteristics of the relationship? Under what circumstances will you trust them to not look at the details of your transactions?
If the details of the transactions are not revealed to them.
That they have to be revealed because the server that's running them has to be able to execute them.
Well, you know, this is the point. This model of mutualization of infrastructure has not yet arrived in the banks. And people are, you know, there are probably no firm guidelines on this topic. I mean, the point is that can you do the verification without looking at the details? Yes, there are ways to do it. You are presupposing that there aren't.
I know at least one way to do it, but but that's not how it works. I mean, first off, that's not how it works today. And second, at least not in Fabric. And second, there are prices to pay for that.
Of course. Right?
So for example, you know, one approach to do it is to use zero knowledge proofs. That constrains greatly the set of things that you can express in any computationally interesting way. Second approach is to use trusted hardware to do it, which gives you hardware level performance, which is nice, but you have to trust the trusted execution environment to preserve the integrity of it. Right? Yeah, so you've got institutional trust, you've got trust in the zero knowledge proof cryptography with the ability to express limited function, or you've got to trust hardware. So how would you differentiate between the trust relationships that you have with those?
Because in one, you are giving somebody a choice to be evil or not. In the other, they need to work at it to be evil, meaning they have to break the zero knowledge proof or they have to do something. And in the hardware case, yeah, sure, you're trusting the TEE, but you're trusting everything. Like, hardware, I know that there are bugs. I know about the problems in Intel and all those things, but it doesn't mean that people don't use hardware, right? I mean, they do. Even in the most secret, in the most secret. So I would rather try to sell those two things than saying, okay, I'm gonna trust that the people, the validators are not going to look inside the data. So the motto would be, can't be evil rather than don't be evil, right? So that's the key. I mean, you try to reveal as little in a practical way. There might be costs associated with it, both in time and in effort, meaning somebody has to actually think about the ZK proofs, or somebody has to install this trusted hardware. But I could sell that internally rather than something saying, oh, we're going to send everything to everybody and people are going to look inside this stuff and we trust them not to. Or even if they do look inside, don't use it for their purposes. It never works. Meaning there are always cases where those boundaries have been broken. But in the other two cases, I mean, of course, you can say, some of these cryptography will be broken in the future, can be broken, or whatever it is. But these are, doing business in the real world entails risk, right? If you don't do anything, then there's no risk. What will be acceptable in a bank would be something like the second two things rather than the first.
So Vipin, I mean, I think what we were trying to get you to, you and Stan and Todd to kind of delineate was, what are acceptable risks? What is okay to leak, basically? This is just what we were wondering. I mean, you can forget all the technical stuff if you want, and we can just handle that. But if we don't know, like I don't know what is an acceptable risk for a bank today. And that's kind of what I was hoping to understand.
Okay, here's what I'm saying. I said it before, I'm going to restate it again. There has been nothing like this before, right? I mean, blockchain, where you mutualize the infrastructure, mutualize the various interactions, has not been around before. And several people who have worked on this have come up with different methods to solve the problem, technical methods, right? Like DAH, like Corda, like IBM with the channels and all that. But I can't give you an answer about what would be acceptable to these guys. I mean, I know what they're looking for, but if the business says, I want my P&L, and these are the risks that I'm willing to accept, So I can't give you the answer that you're looking for.
I can try to give the answer from like my side.
Okay.
So, I mean, and actually, ironically, you know, at CME, we are actually officially a trusted third party, right? We're the clearinghouse. So guess it's our responsibility to keep the data once we receive it private and not share it with anyone else. We are assuming that the communications are bilateral, like to each of the counterparties, so they do not see each other's data. As far as attacks on those channels, then I guess our first and foremost concern is, well, two really, there's authentication and then the confidentiality of the data. So if somebody observes, does the traffic analysis, we're kind of accepting that it exists. It would be very unfavorable. But then it's the other party that decides how badly, I guess, to a mixed point, right? How badly do they want to hide it? Because then there's cost. They want to do a private physical connection. Great. They are okay with just doing VPN. Fine. They want to do just regular, you know, TLS. That works if they are okay with it and they accept the risks. So it doesn't help probably to define the kind of a formal definition of what's acceptable risk, but I think it's going to have to be looked at case by case basis for each of the communications. Right. Certain things are more or less prone to traffic analysis, and certain things are less important, whether you know about their existence or not. I think the data itself, I believe there's expectation that the data itself is always private to the only the counterparties. Don't know if it helps at all.
Yeah, that was useful. This would seem to support the fact, which we kind of already suspected, that we need, you know, several different models or assumptions, right? Not just one.
Right.
Because different people are going to have different concerns about their data, right?
And the kind of variability comes in that decision is not necessarily made on technical merits, but purely on a business decision of the participant.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, this is back to Mick's point, right? It comes down to economics.
Yep. Yeah, like everybody would love to have a dedicated line, to talk to.
But even a dedicated line though is not completely secure, right?
Within our data center.
Okay. But then even within there, if you still have
cyber reservations,
right? Yeah.
But I think I'll give you my response to that, which is. That there's and this is what we're really struggling with on the threat models that we're trying to define for SGX, which is at some level they have to come back to economics. That is, how much information can you get out of a communication channel given that I have a certain amount of money that I can spend on creating that channel? I'm not proposing we do that here necessarily. We've found that we have to go to that kind of formulation of it in order to have an accurate reflection of what we're trying to accomplish.
Well, and you have to make an assumption about the amount of money that an attacker can throw at the problem, right?
Exactly, and that's kind of the approach as we're saying, okay, you know, an attacker that has $5 million could accomplish this, an attacker that has $5,000 could accomplish this. and trying to differentiate those things, because then we can tie that again to sort of the value of the information that they expose. If it takes $5 million to get $100 worth of information, clearly that's not going to be economically reasonable. So that's the direction we're taking. I don't know if that's appropriate here. It feels like a lot of these decisions that we make, in particular in these enterprise systems, are balances between risk and dollars. And I don't know, Hart, that feels like a different formulation. Again, in our looking around at things, we haven't been able to find good economic models for stuff. If you know of any, that would be helpful.
No, that gets into like very, very, so the only economic kind of papers I've seen have been kind of Bitcoin focused, right?
Right.
Have which you are read that?
Yeah. The game theoretic approaches and some of the others like that, which are interesting, and we've been trying to internalize that, but there's not a lot else that we've been able to find that helps. So. We are more or less at time. I want to just, you know, we've got 4 minutes left. I just want to kind of go through and make sure everybody's had a chance to get their say in. So, Todd, anything else from you?
No, I get back to the, it is an economic model issue, I think, because any assumptions about security, privacy, confidentiality, and stuff like that, have an assumption about what can be attacked and how much it can be attacked and, you know, how much resources. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we talked a lot of discussion during this meeting about, you know, a private line, right? A fiber channel from my place to your place. And I think we need to come up with a way to quantify that, right? That's much lower risk than, you know, HTTP traffic over the internet, but it's not without risk.
Right.
And I think we need to come up with a model that describes that the trade-offs there, I guess, that are being made.
So do we evaluate it based on economics or different attack vectors? Because economics actually may be easier at that point.
Wait, I'm sorry, what was the last part of that?
So do we evaluate it based on, basically the cost of that channel is based on the attack vectors or just the pure economics?
If it's a fiber,
you can't like directly observe it. Still tells you nothing about really the veracity of the data. If you do like VPN, there are different attack vectors. You do, TLS over internet, different attack vectors.
It's got to be both, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
Well, that's kind of complicated things.
Yeah, it's going to complicate things for sure. Sorry, I was off. I was just listening.
Great. Clive, I know you added some stuff into the notes. Thank you very much for that. Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to share?
Not really. Just the only observation is just working tightly with Jeremy, the requirements working group. Jeremy, this is one thing that he was attempting to instill and convey to us, was that the banks wouldn't actually implement blockchain until everything was locked down at this very nitty-gritty level that you've been talking about today. And he did quite a bit of work in this Strawman document. I think it's probably, you've all scooted past this document, but it may be, there may be some some interesting nuggets.
We should pull out of there. Okay. Yeah. And that document was essentially one that was put together by the requirements working group.
Yes.
Because I think that becomes very important. Yeah. Okay. So I'll go make sure I take a look at that and read through it on that.
But Jeremy's arguments are 2 years old.
Yes.
But that's fine. At least it's good input into it. And whether or not they're modern or not, we need to think through it.
The thinking on this has evolved, I'm sure the use of the open internet will not be frowned upon if it delivers business value.
Okay. Last one, Amit. Anything to add?
Yeah, hello. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yeah. And this hyperlayer architecture, but I would like to add means some people in the indie group, they have a proposed some idea means they have an idea means some LDAP services they would like to implement in this blockchain technology. So my concern is that it's a totally based on decentralized activity we are doing so far. So if we go for LDAP services to implement for architecting blockchain, so it will be beneficial because it would be become centralized if we use a LDAP concept. So I need your concern about this.
Hey, Mick, Ram here as well.
Yeah.
I would say, the approach of classifying it into three models for communication, completely private network, VPN, which has intermediate protection, especially if it's kind of bilateral VPNs connections, and third one being, TLS kind of connections over the public internet, in which case the data itself is protected. And the side channels information observable. Those three look like reasonable variations that we can talk to. And perhaps we can just do the technical analysis and leave the economic impact of those three models separately.
Okay. Could you do me a favor and write up the description of those three in the notes? I was fiddling with formatting, but I like your characterization of those three. If you could capture that, that'd be great. We are past time at this point, and I don't want to consume the one and only channel, Tracy. We'll meet again in 2 weeks then. Thank you all for participating. Good discussion.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Bye for now. Ram, I'll be gone next week, so I'll miss the architecture working group meeting.
No, thanks for the heads up, Hart. We'll catch up later.
Yep, talk to you later.
No problem. Go ahead. Thank you.